Another scandal is revealed involving nuclear missile officers at Malmstrom Air Force Base. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has more on the potential health effects of lead contamination discovered at a Helena Middle School. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with historian Michael Wise about the systematic eradication of wolves in Montana in the early 20th century. The Air Force says 34 nuclear missile launch officers at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls have been implicated in a cheating scandal and have been stripped of their certification in what is believed to be the largest such breach of integrity in the nuclear force. Some of the officers apparently texted to each other the answers to a monthly test on their knowledge of how to operate the missiles. Others may have known about it but did not report it. The cheating was discovered during a drug investigation that involves 11 Air Force officers across six bases in the U.S. and England. Of the three missile launch officers involved in the drug scandal, two are at Malmstrom and one is at F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. The two at Malmstrom are among those implicated in the cheating scandal. It's the latest controversy involving the service members who maintain and operate the nation's 450 nuclear missiles. And in other news from around the state, Helena parents are still waiting to hear results from further lead testing at C.R. Anderson Middle School. The school abruptly closed yesterday after initial tests found elevated lead levels at the site of the building's old firing range. Analysts today are determining if that lead contamination spread farther than the basement. This could significantly increase the time the state's largest middle school needs to remain closed for cleaning. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce looks into the health concerns which may be facing the kids at CR.
Kathy Moore is the administrator of the Environmental Division of the Lewis and Clark City County Health Department. Her department is trying to offer whatever information and help they can to Helena school officials regarding lead. It's something our office has a lot of experience talking about.
We have a Superfund site in East Helena. The primary contaminant is lead.
Lead exposure can lead to symptoms like abdominal pain, aggressive behavior, difficulty sleeping, a low appetite. Long periods of exposure can cause permanent neurological damage.
ADD or behavioral difficulties.
And here's what she says about the situation at C.R. Anderson Middle School. So far, tests are showing some isolated areas in the school's basement with lead concentrations 25 times what's considered healthy by the federal government. She says this is a cause for concern, but not a cause for panic. A person has to actually come in contact with lead for it to be considered a threat. The lead found in C.R. Anderson so far has been in areas like up in the ceiling tiles or on light fixtures.
So unless they actually climbed up onto a chair or a table and wipe their hand across the top of the light and then lick their hand, they're probably not going to be exposed to the lead dust that we saw.
The school district will be paying for blood tests to check for any lead poisoning in students if parents want. The basement shooting range thought responsible for the contamination shut down about 20 years ago, and Moore says it's possible C.R. Anderson students have been exposed to lead before and since then. But she says testing will not benefit anyone but those who have recently spent time in the building.
People who are exposed to lead, once that exposure quits, blood lead levels rapidly drop in their body.
C.R. Anderson Middle School will be closed through at least next Tuesday. I'm Dan Boyce reporting in Helena.
School administrators are holding a meeting for parents at Capitol High School tonight at 7 p.m. to provide the results of further testing into the lead contamination. Ravalli County is issuing checks to towns, fire districts, libraries, and other entities that haven't received any tax payments since September due to a backlog in the treasurer's office. The finance department issued between $1.5 and $2 million in checks yesterday, a day after the county commission held an emergency meeting and decided to bring in State Department of Administration staff to provide guidance to Treasurer Valerie Stamey. Chief Financial Officer Clarice Murphy says normally the finance office can't assist the treasurer's office because the offices are supposed to be separate. Commissioners decided after Monday's meeting to have Murphy's office review the amounts that should go to each entity and write checks. Stamey was appointed treasurer in September. Since then, three of the office's most experienced employees left, questioning Stamey's ability to do the work. Montana State veterinarian Marty Zalewski is disappointed in this week's Park Service decision against remote vaccination of Yellowstone National Park's bison against brucellosis. The disease is feared by ranchers because it can cause pregnant cows to prematurely abort their young. Yellowstone administrators say shooting the animals with vaccine-laced bio-bullets would be too ineffective to justify the projected $9 million expense over the next 3 decades. Zalewski says that flies in the face of data within the proposal's own environmental impact statement.
The modeling that the decision was based on showed a disease reduction of over 35%. The modeling showed that the current disease rate is about 50% in the bison, but this effort would reduce the brucellosis prevalence rates down to about 16% in 30 years. So it's a long-term effort that would require a fair bit of personnel and taxpayer dollars, but I would suggest that the yield can be significant.
Zalewski says the cattle industry has worked hard and spent a lot of money to eradicate brucellosis in domestic cattle and adds more needs to be done on the wildlife side of the equation.
In 1956, we had 124,000 infected brucellosis herds in cattle. And by the 90s, we've reduced it down to 700. So we, in less than 40 years, we took our infection rate in the cattle industry down to less than 0.5%. I would suggest that if agencies put their efforts behind these kinds of programs, we can make a dramatic difference.
He readily acknowledges that managing and vaccinating wildlife is more challenging than doing the same for domestic animals.
Having said that, you know, we have experience in managing bison in particular. Elk are obviously much more difficult because they're far more widely dispersed on the landscape. The disease rate is much lower. But bison, you know, bison are routinely captured at the periphery of Yellowstone National Park on just about a yearly basis. So, I mean, we know how to capture bison. We know how to vaccinate those animals. This proposal for remote vaccination varies in our current approach slightly, but the challenges that are associated with using these bio-bullets certainly can be overcome.
Earlier this week, the State Board of Livestock voted against a plan to allow more bison into areas of Montana north and west of Yellowstone. The board also decided that further study is needed on a plan to more aggressively capture and vaccinate bison crossing the park's western boundary. Students and faculty from the University of Montana have escaped the winter chill of Missoula for a much more exotic location, India. Denise Dowling reports on the study abroad experience that is expanding their minds and their hearts.
It's right by the water. It looks like a turkey.
Oh, my God.
Like
an
egret? Oh my God.
I think it's an ibis.
An ibis. There we go.
Ibis?
The bird lady.
Ibis. Oh, I love them. I love them so much.
Morgan Erickson Davis is a graduate student in environmental studies at the University of Montana. She joined the School of Journalism's study abroad program to India to get a firsthand look at species she's only read about.
These are usually crepuscular species. They like morning and evening, you know? Like, why are they walking around the hottest part of the day, broad daylight?
The group of 27 students and faculty set out from Missoula on New Year's Day. Their reporting experience began with safaris on the Tadoba Andari Tiger Reserve in central India. There they saw wild dogs, monkeys, bison, boar, and on this day, a tiger.
Tiger relaxing. Tiger grooming.
Oh, yeah,
the tiger sleeping.
The environmental reporting course has students studying the conflict between preserving the tiger and promoting tourism, a balancing act that has, so far, improved the local economies around the reserve and kept tiger populations at a healthy level.
My mother was very, 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 very anxious.
Journalism major Alexandria Valdez had never left the United States before this trip. She sees the opportunity in this journey to a country unlike anything she's known.
The people are so different, so I've just tried to keep a very open mind and an open heart, and I think it's really helped me appreciate and love this whole trip so far.
I think I want to go along. It would be great fun.
University of Montana President Royce Engstrom has a goal to give more and more students experiences like this one.
It's important to our students to leave the university with a good understanding of the major issues before us so that they can, when they enter their chosen profession, they can address those challenges and problems and opportunities really with full understanding of how their actions and decisions are affected by things happening around the world and also how their decisions and actions affect things happening around the world.
Engstrom sees the benefit not only for the students, but for Montana businesses as well.
You can hardly think of a business in Montana, a major part of our economic sector, that doesn't have global connections, global implications, whether it's agriculture, the energy industry, tourism, retail, all of these things have major global implications and global connections.
Valdez says she thinks Engstrom's goal is worthwhile.
Oh, yeah, I think it's fantastic. I mean, I had never traveled out of the country before, but there was always a little part of me that was like, you know, it would be really fun to experience something new.
And while Valdez is soaking up all India has to offer, she says this experience has made her appreciate what she has at home.
The only thing I'm really, really missing is a hamburger. I would love to have a hamburger, but two more weeks.
It's so hot.
The group returns home in time for the start of the spring semester at the University of Montana. Reporting from Pune, India, I'm Denise Dowling for Montana Evening Edition.
You can follow the students' adventures on the UM School of Journalism Facebook page or go to umt2india.com. As we reported earlier this week, a new article on the history of the eradication of wolves in Montana points out the state once was home to hundreds of thousands of wolves. The current population of 600-plus is a tiny fraction of the number of wolves that used to roam Big Sky Country before wolves were exterminated in the 1920s. University of North Texas historian Michael Wise authored the article on the elimination of Montana's wolves, published in the winter issue of Montana, the magazine of Western history. In this feature interview, Wise talks with News Director Sally Mock about the rise and fall of the wolf in Montana. The rise began in the mid-19th century when hunters began slaughtering bison for their fur.
Within, you know, approximately 30 or 40 years during the mid-19th century, the population of bison in Montana and elsewhere in the northern plains went from, you know, figures in the millions to down, you know, by the end of the 1880s, a number of something like 23 or something of free-ranging bison left in the Judith Basin, for instance, when a Smithsonian taxidermist, William Hornaday, came out to Montana to shoot half of them to taxidermy. These bison were shot not for meat and not really for their hides either, as was the case in Texas and across the southern plains, but in Montana for their robes, which were the intact winter furs. And so this is part of a larger fur trade in peltries, linked in with the beaver trade, with thriving trade in wolf pelts as well. But all these skinned bison really left sort of a harvest of free meat for wolves to eat. And so, wolf populations most likely expanded over these years, not because they were necessarily preying on bison, but scavenging the carcasses.
And at one point, there were approximately 1.5 million wolves roaming the northern plains, which puts the figure at hundreds of thousands roaming Montana at one time, something I don't think most of us realize.
Yeah, I mean, most likely that's the case. That's the historical estimate. So, that's sort of, I would say, an upward guess. But yeah, certainly in the hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands. Yeah, I think, most people who I talk to are startled just when they realize, the number of wolves that were killed under the bounty system alone in Montana. 1899 was sort of the climax year for the bounty bills, and over 23,000 wolves were killed in Montana that year alone. In 1870, 1871, one fur company alone in Montana, CC Power Company, which is one of the big four Benton fur trading companies, sold almost 34,000 wolf pelts down the Missouri River over just a couple of years in the early 1870s. So, and that figure itself, 34,000, is not accounted for in that bounty bill figure. So, I mean, that just sort of gives an indication of the scale of, you know, this project of extermination.
And puts into perspective the alarm that there are now a few hundred wolves in Montana. There are people who believe that's too many. It's way, way below what it historically was.
Yeah, that's certainly right. But, you know, part of the environmental history of Montana that I think we all need to keep in mind also is that Montana looked a lot different in the 19th century than it does now. I mean, today it's largely a landscape that's been gridded by industrial agriculture. So that's really the challenge that wolf conservationists face is how do we reincorporate wolves into a landscape that's really been fundamentally altered from how it's looked in the past.
And, of course, the eradication of the wolf in Montana began to make way for that agriculture, to make way for cattle primarily.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that really fascinated me when I started the research on this project was how the people who were actually killing wolves, the wolfers themselves, weren't really on board with the livestock industry's goal of eradicating wolves. They were in it for the day-to-day money-making possibilities. So it was never really in their interest to eradicate wolves. And so this sort of led to some stumbling with the bounty bill legislation. It turned out to be not nearly as effective as people had intended. And it was largely a failure. I mean, after being implemented for 30 years, it wasn't until salaried federal wolf hunters eradicated wolves that, you know, this project in Montana became complete.
I'll get to the federal hunters, but I want to go back a little bit to some of the techniques that were used to kill wolves initially, and some of them involved lacing the bison carcasses with strychnine, which it seems to me must have caused harm to other species besides wolves at that time.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, this was a common practice before the bounty bills were put into place, when wolves were being trapped primarily for their furs, because they had become so habituated to these human-killed animals that they would scavenge. It was pretty easy for trappers not to really set traps at all, but just simply to bait carcasses and lace them with strychnine. So, of course, it killed wolves, it killed foxes, it killed coyotes, magpies, probably a host of other animals as well. The Blackfeet and other indigenous people in Montana and Alberta and elsewhere where this took place also lost numbers of their dogs. And so it became, not controversial in the same ways that controversies over these poisons, similar poisons in the 1950s, 1960s, but pretty quickly became controversial in the mid-19th century, too, in ways that people might not necessarily expect.
Your article points out how adaptable the wolf was, though, that despite all these rather dire measures to eradicate it, as you say, the eradication didn't really come about until professional government, federal government hunters set about to killing off the wolf.
Yeah, there have been a number of studies that biologists have made in the last 10 or 20 years studying wolf populations that show that annual human-caused mortality rates within a certain pretty broad window, percentage-wise, actually lead to an increase in the wolf population rather than a decrease in the wolf population. This is pretty similar with most canids, most wild dogs. It's certainly a problem. You think about this as sort of like the dingo effect in Australia, where despite all sort of attempts to eradicate dingoes in Australia, the population had seemed for years and years to just keep growing and growing and growing. And that has to do with the range that's available to these animals. And so, you know, if you eliminate a number of wolves, but not all of them, then basically it gives more food resources to the wolves that remain. And, the well-nourished wolves will, in turn, theoretically raise larger litters of pups. Then another reason why the bounty bills were a failure was really because it was never in the best interest of the people performing the labor of wolf eradication to eradicate wolves, that they're being paid by the wolf. One of my favorite examples of the fraud that's associated with the program was wolf ranching, where wolfers would secretly take a breeding pair of wolves and hold them in captivity and raise their pups to slaughter for the bounty, sort of like a shadow livestock industry. So, you know, the creation of these state incentives to eradicate wolves sort of worked both ways. It also provided an incentive to not eradicate wolves. And so this is just one of the examples of the interesting ambiguities and sort of ambivalent attitudes that Montanans have historically had towards wolves that aren't so much reflected in this assumption that there's been a timeless antagonism between wolves and people until recent times.
It's not true that wolves were killed because they were hated, necessarily.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. Regardless of whether or not the bounty bills had succeeded or whether or not they failed, one of the outcomes that these bounty bills did establish, in my analysis, both in this particular article and also in a larger book that I'm finishing up, is that really what killing wolves did for Montanans, for stock growers in particular, was allow them to perform a role that they were producers rather than predators. Because at the end of the day, what really separates a livestock producer from a livestock predator? What separates us from, you know, predators in general? And in my argument, my analysis here, really the broader significance of the history of wolf eradication programs in Montana and elsewhere is that it offered this late 19th century, early 20th century moment to sort of clarify those boundaries, to use the power of the state to say that raising livestock for meat, for human consumption, for a capitalist market that's going to resell that beef, is a legitimate way of harnessing that value created by an animal. But if a wolf or some other, a cattle rustler or some other predatory agent harnesses that value before it can be realized into its monetary form, then that's predatory, and that's an illegitimate form of work, an illegitimate form of value.
Well, I have been speaking with Dr. Michael Wise, who teaches history at the University of North Texas, and he has written an article called Killing Montana Wolves, Stock Growers, Bounty Bills, and the Uncertain Distinction Between Predators and Producers, published in the winter issue of Montana, the Magazine of Western History. Very interesting article, Dr. Wise, and thank you for your time, and thank you for putting up with my cold, bad voice.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly clear with some patchy freezing fog and lows in the teens. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with some patchy freezing fog in the morning and highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana tonight it should be partly cloudy with lows in the 20s with wind gusts up to 55 miles per hour. Tomorrow look for sunny skies with highs 35 to 45 degrees. And in southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly clear skies, lows 15 to 25 degrees, and wind gusts up to 35 miles per hour. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs in the 30s. And now for the editorial comments of Mary Sheehy Moe.
Be my last commentary on this program. As I pondered what to say in parting, I landed on what I should have said to you at the start, why I think ongoing commentary on the subject of public education is important. I started my teaching career in a private all-boys school run by monks in Louisiana. It was a wonderful introduction to what schools can do when parents are literally invested in them, and when the kids are all bright and shiny and eager to learn. But it wasn't real somehow, and it wasn't home. I missed Montana terribly, and I wanted to teach regular kids. So after 3 years in Louisiana, I came back home, and for the next 15 years, I taught Montana kids in Montana high schools. Over that span of time, I figure I taught or coached over 2,000 kids. I taught the little town flirts, the class clowns, the jocks, the stoners, the nerds, the full range of students you encounter in a public school. I got pretty good at it, or so I thought. Graduates would come back years later and tell me I was the one who taught them to write, or I got them interested in drama, or they could never read a short story now without thinking of things like foreshadowing. That made me feel good. But in 1990, I got a new job in Helena at what was then called the Votech, and there I met the students I hadn't taught. I learned that some of them had to leave high school to raise their own children. Some had come from home environments so abysmal it's a wonder they could focus on anything at all. Some just got tired of year after year of feeling dumb or ignored or uncool, and whether they left school or not, they tossed in the towel on their own potential somewhere along the way. A half dozen students like these were probably sitting in every high school class I taught. They weren't learning what I thought I was teaching, so I had written them off as unmotivated, irresponsible, lazy. I had overcrowded classrooms, I told myself, and there wasn't enough time in the day. I had to focus on the kids who wanted to learn. But now, at the VOTEC, those other students were back. Maybe an injury had made their job in construction impossible to continue. Maybe they couldn't make a living wage in the jobs they could get without some college education. Whatever the reason, they were back in school again, terrified, with their hopes and their hearts on their sleeves. And they were adults now. They wanted to succeed, needed to succeed, and they weren't going to let me shrug off their challenges or write off their potential. Working with these students in an environment where every student mattered, I had to come to terms with the subtle ways schools can be inhumane. I had to confront the fact that all the little labels I used and excuses I trotted out for not teaching every student in my classroom had contributed to that humanity. It wasn't all my fault, of course. Some of my students had been incredibly rude, insolent, lazy. But they were just kids. I was the adult. I should have done better. For the next 18 years, I think I did. Montana's Constitution stipulates that it is the goal of public education in Montana to develop the full educational potential of every individual. 35 years in public education, working with individuals from 12 years of age to 82, and from fifth grade to graduate school, I got to see that potential in all its thousands of forms. I got to see what happens when you don't develop it, and I got to see what happens when you do. And because of that, I left those years even more idealistic and optimistic about public education than I was when I entered them. Our public schools prepare students for college, for careers, for life. They give students the tools they need to make complex decisions in a complex world. They give them the background and understanding they need to make this democratic republic something they can help shape. They create healthier citizens who contribute more to the economic, social, and cultural welfare of our communities. Public schools don't just educate the public, they create it. Public education is the only experience in American life where people of vastly different backgrounds, circumstances, and belief systems are forced to sit side by side year after year, learning about the world they share and, in the process, about one another. As countless friendships throughout the state illustrate, that shared experience is a glue that binds exceptionally well in Montana. But above all, public education, whether in kindergarten, high school, community college, or graduate school, develops the full potential of all the marvelous individuals we call Montanans. When we turn our backs on our public schools, when we find excuses not to support them, when we write them off as antiquated, expensive, ineffective, we are thwarting the potential of countless human beings who really can be contenders. Equally unforgivable, we are jeopardizing our own potential as a state and as a country. Do our schools have problems? Absolutely. Could they be improved? Always. But the answer for our society is the same answer I learned at that old VOTEC. We have to care more. We have to do more. We have to understand the problems better, and we have to find better ways to solve them. And that was always the intent of my commentaries. Ever the English teacher, I'll close with a story. I had the pleasure last month of watching a GED graduation at Great Falls College. As always, the graduating class ran the gamut from very young women with very young children to a 72-year-old valedictorian. As always, the graduates were giddy with the joy of finally having a high school credential. Most of them had arrived on that stage through a long and tortuous journey with failures and disappointments as milestones. But because of their own persistence and the caring environment that GED program provides, they made it to the finish line. When the ceremony ended, the group posed for a picture. One of the graduates shied away and headed for the door. The program director hurried after him, urging, "Don't you want to get your picture taken?" He turned around, smiled, and said, "I don't need a picture. I've got it all here in my heart." Once a month for the past year on this program, I've tried to paint a good picture of some aspect of public education for you. But that graduate was right. Ultimately, you don't need a good picture. You just need a good heart. Take care of yourselves, listeners, and please, please take care of our public schools, colleges, and universities. This is Mary Sheehy Moe, retired, but still advocating for free, quality public education in Montana.
Mary Sheehy Moe was one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening.